the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the Church and the world, and we say just love. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. Tragically, as we kind of are on the air now, we're still in the tragic aftermath of that awful, tragic attack, bombings, killings, murders in Paris, in which more than 100 people lost their lives through a terrorist attack in the middle of Paris. And so it is with an incredible amount of sadness and upsetment, frustration, anger, a lot of different emotions are part of our kind of reflections upon that. And so it is not a very, very happy or pleasant situation that we're in. And then the response of taking some action to try to prevent that in the future and to retaliate against that, it's not a very, very not a very, very kind of pleasant situation at all, a very tragic and awful situation. And so we thought today on Just Love we would kind of do a little bit of a reflection upon that and talking about some of those issues. Our first guest is going to be Dahlia Muggahead, who is the Director of Research for the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding. She herself was born in Egypt, and she studied in the United States, and she will bring us a lot of insights from her research, her studies, and some of her personal experience about how what are some of the strong realities going on in the world that we're trying to deal with. And then a little bit later on in the show, towards the end of the show, we're going to speak with Dr. Matthew Shadley, who is the Associate Professor of Theology and Religious Studies at Marymount University in Arlington, Virginia. And we're going to speak with him a little bit about our Catholic Christian tradition of trying to understand how we justly use violence and how we kind of justly use force in war and talk about that. And I have no problem in kind of saying up front, as I've said a few other times with some other guests, is I really think that we need to revamp and rethink our just war theory. Not that some of the values and the principles which the just war theory seeks to kind of help us to put into practice, but the world has changed so radically that some of the core concepts of that just war theory just are not part of the reality of the world we live in. And so I think we need to kind of rethink that, update it, develop it to deal with the contemporary reality of war in our world. So those are kind of the main things we're going to do this week, but we also have a few other things we're going to do, too. You know, part of what we deal with is in terms of the rupture of the world. And last week, I gave Angie a little bit of homework in terms of kind of figuring out what those divisions are and where they come from the Bible. So a little bit later on, we're going to give her a little bit more chance to be able to kind of think about that, to see if she did her homework, because I did promise her that I'd give her an apple crisp if she did her homework. So we're going to see if she did her homework. So anyway, so that's the situation. Tom, is there any news before we go to our first guest?
There is, Monsignor. No, as you mentioned, we're talking today about the aftermath of what went on this past week. And of course, one of the things that wound up going on is I think there was just great concern that's been evinced both in Europe and here in the United States regarding migration, and particularly migration from the Middle East, particularly migration from Syria. And just the news this week, it turns out that now 31 governors, more than half of the nation's governors, majority of them from Republican from Republican-led states, have stated that they do not wish to relocate any new Syrian refugees in their state, that they're worried that this poses violent extremism. They're worried that if they gain entry to the state, that that there will be repercussions that wind up coming afterwards. So a majority of the governors have done that. Some governors have come out in the alternative, and they said that they're willing to accept refugees. Those states are fewer. Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Pennsylvania, Vermont, Washington State, and New York. But they, I think that this is something that's really been brewing in the country. This is something that I think a lot of people have been talking about. The president himself, in response to some of these things, has indicated that he feels that this is not an American position to take, that we do not have religious tests for people who wind up coming to our country seeking help or seeking aid. And I think this is just something that, you know, we are going to continue to see in the coming weeks and months, Monsignor, as we kind of live through this aftermath.
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk a little bit more about this in the middle of the show, but I have to say I'm a little bit frustrated and a little bit angry about how people who are quoted, people in the newspaper, and people who kind of talk about these things really don't have the slightest idea what they're talking about in terms of reality. You can have your own, as oftentimes I say, you know, you can have your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. But just a little test. Angie, how many Syrian refugees do you think are in this huge New York area? How many Syrian refugees?
Oh,
In New York. How many Syrian refugees have been resettled in New York? Just give a guess.
A couple thousand?
Yeah, nine.
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 Okay, but around the United States, what is it?
I don't know what the number is, but nine.
Nine, okay.
I did this test with some other people, and I got numbers from 30,000, 10,000, 14,000.
Well, I don't feel so bad anymore for saying a couple thousand.
Right. But why do I point that out? I point that out because if we're going to have an intelligent conversation about what we should do as public policy, and there are intelligent conversations to be had about this issue, could we at least begin with a little bit of reality? Could we also begin with the fact that whether you disagree or don't agree, that in order to become a refugee that is resettles in the United States, that you have to go through about 10 steps in order to get resettled in the United States, so that it's the pictures that sometimes we see in the paper of what's going on in Europe and how people in the European Union, there are no boundaries or no borders and no checkpoints and things like that. It's a little bit helpful to understand what the reality is in the United States. And, you know, I said 10. Actually, I think there are 13 steps that it takes to get to be a refugee in the United States. And the other reality, which, you know, again, I'm sorry, but this is part of the real world being a grown-up that we have to deal with. There's nothing in life, as far as I can tell, that's 100% certain. And so when everybody says we need to be 100% certain, we need to be completely, well, I'm sorry, that's not the world that we live in. Do we have to take steps to try to get better at certain things, that we have to try to make sure that things are safe? But the reality is there's no absolute guarantee of things being perfect and whatever. And I mean, with a little bit of tongue in cheek, I always mention this, which again, maybe some people think it's a little bit blasphemous, but I mean, who do you think, give me a guess, who do you think was the best kind of religious ed teacher of all time? Who was the one who was kind of really the best of all time? Who would you think? Who would you, Angie?
You?
No. No, not me. No, of all time. It's obvious.
Jesus?
Jesus.
Jesus.
Jesus, right?
Yes, of course.
Okay. Now, tell me about Judas.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
So even Jesus, the best of all time, the Son of God, the Savior of the world, he calls 12 to be his closest intimates, and one of them doesn't turn out right. You know? So, yeah. I mean, if we're looking for, and this is hard, but if we're looking for a world in which we can be assured of the outcomes of everything and perfect security and everything being right, that's not the world that we live in. It's not the world that Jesus came to save us in. It's a world in which there are imperfections and there are things that are tragically going to ruin. And sometimes it's not terribly popular to say this, but we do believe in a reality of sin, that people do bad things, and sometimes they intentionally do bad things. And you know, that's part of the world we live in. It's not, sometimes maybe it's not terribly comforting, but that is just the reality of the world that that we live in. So anyway, so let's go to our first guest, because I think it's very, very important that we speak with people who have a lot of information and firsthand experience. So our first guest is Dalia Mogahed, the Director of Research for the Institute of Social Policy and Understanding. Dalia, thank you so much for being with us on Just Love today.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Well, this is not an easy time in our world, is it?
Absolutely not. I think we're all absolutely outraged at the senseless and savage taking of innocent life that happened last Friday.
You know, I think that's true, and it's easy to say that. And I think the other thing, which I think is, as I was just talking a little bit about, Dalia, is I think we sometimes feel so helpless about what we can do about it. And I think that almost adds to both the frustration and maybe it adds to some of the anger and the emotion.
Yes, we feel helpless and we want to take control back, because what these terrible events make us feel is how little control we often have in our lives. And so we want to respond by exerting control. And sometimes that impulse to want to, you know, take back control can make us act in.
Okay, I think we lost Dalia. But we were talking about she was talking about how we react to those situations in which we want to take back control. But it is one of those situations in which there is such a feeling of powerlessness. And sometimes I think what we wind up doing is we wind up wanting to take back control with regard to things that have nothing to do with the reality that kind of caused the violence. And I mean, you know, it's kind of, we do what we can, but sometimes what we can do doesn't actually deal with the problem. And it may just be a way of kind of, you know, fighting back about the situation. I mean, it's interesting. In a lot of different places this past week, something was very kind of really caught me by surprise when you looked at some of the reactions and some of the things that people said that we should do, that it just, you know, had nothing to do with what went on, but it was a response to it. Dalia, thank you for, I'm sorry that we lost you in, but you were talking about how we try to control things.
Yes, I apologize for that.
No problem.
Technical difficulty. I think that when these horrible things happen, it reminds us of how little control we sometimes have. And as human beings, we want to get that control back. And so we often respond in ways that can, in an effort to get that control back, that can make things much worse.
It is. And we just kind of sometimes we just lash out without any kind of rational reason to lash out. We just do it.
Yeah, we want someone to be held responsible, and it's not enough sometimes to just hold those people who in fact committed these horrible crimes responsible. We want that blame to go much further, and I think that that's really where the danger lies. The more I read about these horrific acts, the more I'm convinced that their aim was to polarize, was to divide, of course, and was to terrorize. And I'm afraid that in our response, we are often giving them exactly what they want.
So I think, you know, I think you're right. And we've watched enough kind of movies of intrigue or spy movies and things like that, where sometimes people act in one way to create a different reaction. And I know I get a little bit confused when I watch some of those things, because I don't know, is this the time they're moving in the opposite direction or whatever? So, and I'm going to ask you kind of an unfair question. I mean, it certainly seems to me that, you know, when an incident, when something terrible, horrific like this happens, government has to respond in some way. What are some of the appropriate responses that don't feed into the divisiveness or feed into what's intended by the terrorist acts?
Sure. I think that that's a great question, actually. First, I think we should take a step back and ask, what are the terrorists trying to do? Well, first, they're trying to gain more recruits. When they do these spectacular acts that get them a lot of media, what they're trying to do is recruit. When you look at a group like ISIS, it is much more of a media organization than a military organization. They expend millions on their media effort. They want to be known around the world, and they want to try to recruit. Now, what helps them do that is this narrative of a war between religions, that the whole world is against Muslims, and they are the only defenders of Muslims. So do we give them what they want by upping our rhetoric that sounds very anti-Muslim and very divisive, or do we do the opposite and say this is about humanity versus these criminals, and people across faith groups are united against this kind of terrorist act? That is the opposite of what they want to hear, and yet we often don't hear that very message. The second thing I think governments need to do is treat this event just like any other terrible shooting that we see around the world, a criminal act that needs to be addressed by using a normal criminal investigation, holding people accountable who were involved, rather than implicating or assigning collective guilt to a community of 1.6 billion people.
And that is, you know, it's interesting because I've had guests on my show in the past, and they said that terror and these type of acts really need to be analyzed more from the perspective of police action than from military action. That's what's going on, and that's the approach that is more effective than the military action. And it resonated with me. I'm not an expert on this, but that certainly seemed to me to make some sense. And I think it's a little bit what you're saying about these acts.
I think we have to be a lot more surgical than respond in a way that's more general, because what these terrorists want to do is increase alienation, increase a sense of grievance. And when we either respond in rhetoric that is very alienating to Muslims around the world, or the blaming of Islam as a whole, or even a response that ends up hurting many people who are not responsible militarily, what we end up doing is providing them exactly what they want, which is more people that feel that alienation that they can then exploit.
You know, I think what some of our listeners probably struggle with a little bit is what's the right vocabulary to use? And before I ask that question, I will say that, you know, Pope Francis has talked against fundamentalism in religion and fundamentalism in Christianity as not being a proper approach to religion. I mean, I have no problem in saying that within every religion, there are people who, I'll say my words, get it wrong, and they get it wrong in a really, really bad way. And so I have no problem saying that there are some people who get it wrong within Islam. Is there a vocabulary that we should use to kind of that people who kind of get religion wrong should be identified as?
I think that there are a number of ways we can refer to them. I think we can call them what they are, which is terrorists. We can call them violent extremists and so forth. But I think one thing that we need to be careful of is handing them the moral victory or the authenticity victory that they crave. So what a group like ISIS wants us to think is that they are the hardcore Muslims, the ones that are really implementing Islam, you know, the way it should be done, and everyone else is just compromising. Whereas it's actually quite the opposite. They are deviant. I wouldn't say they're fundamentalists at all. I think they're actually violating the fundamentals of Islam. They are starting out with a political goal, and working backwards to justify it using text rather than the other way around. We, as Muslims, as Christians, as any kind of believer, we start with God's will, then action should flow from that, and they are doing it the opposite way, where their violence is projected onto the text, and they're interpreting text according to their desired actions, and not the other way around. So I don't want to call them fundamentalists. I want to call them what they are, which is deviants.
You know, we're speaking with Dalia Mogahat, who is the director of research for the Institute of Social Policy and Understanding, and we're talking about the aftermath of the tragic, criminal, violent attacks by individuals in Paris. And we're talking about how the importance of kind of focusing and not kind of giving the attackers what they want, a victory by some of our rhetorical response to it. You know, Dalia, I have to say, maybe I haven't been paying attention, but you're the first person who I've heard use that word deviant when it comes to that. And I kind of like it. You know, in our kind of Christian tradition, we have oftentimes used the word heretical. And quite frankly, I think I'd argue that in common understanding, deviant and heretical are kind of synonyms when it comes to religion. But that is an interesting concept. And I do think words matter in this, because it really can give people a victory. It can be a rallying cry rather than something that is in any way effective in alleviating the problem that we're seeking to address.
Yes, I mean, the interesting thing about, you know, calling them deviants is that it's actually what a large number of scholars have called them. There is a very important letter that's an open letter to ISIS on behalf of hundreds, if not thousands, of Muslim scholars telling them that they are getting it wrong. Not that they're taking Islam and taking it to, you know, a fundamental extreme, but rather they're just plain old wrong. And they are being called deviants, and some people have gone so far as to call them heretics. But deviant is something that there is, you know, enormous consensus about in the scholarly community. They are not behaving or interpreting Islam properly. They are not understanding Islam in a normative, acceptable way.
That is very, I think that's a very, very clear indication. I think that's a very clear presentation of that. And I do think it's very interesting that that you talk about ISIS as being primarily, my words, not yours, but kind of a marketing movement more than a military movement. And yet at the same time, there is a fair amount of land that, at least if, you know, any of the media reports are correct, that ISIS apparently is controlling, that there is a military piece to it, even if it's more a marketing piece.
Of course, they are seizing land and they are conducting military operations, but they would not be who they are, what they are, without their media and marketing arm, and so how they are viewed is quite important, and how we respond to their narrative is vital to defeating them. I want to just add one more point in regards to the issue of what to call them or how to understand them, and that is the simple fact that they most often target Muslims. ISIS is not an organization that until now has ever really targeted people of other faiths. I mean, their primary victims are other Muslims. And interestingly, even in Paris, I've been reading several reports that indicate that they were targeting Western Muslims even then, even though it was in Paris, their primary target within the city were Parisian Muslims.
That's interesting. I'm not arguing with, but how would you know? How would you know who was at the concert?
Yeah, the reports are basing it on their rhetoric and on their statements that Muslims were the target in these attacks. So I think it's important to understand that we must, as believers, as non-believers, as people who uphold the dignity of life, be united against this criminal faction, rather than allow them to divide us, really, in a way that isn't consistent with the facts.
I think that is absolutely, absolutely critical. And I guess what I worry about, Dahlia, is that we're in a world in which a conversation like we're having is probably not terribly attractive to a lot of people who only want to hear what the phrase is and what's the short understanding of it. And that's what I think creates so much of the problem, that everybody needs the two-word soundbite, whether it's, and that's what makes it so difficult to get a deeper understanding of things. I mean, I've been doing this in the past week or so to people, and I could be off by a little bit, but when I recently checked the number of Syrian refugees in New York in recent times, the number was 9. And when you talk to people, they think it's thousands that are here.
Right.
And it's like, if we dealt with a little bit of reality, maybe then we could reach a little bit more common ground.
I completely agree. I think that we are being distracted from the real issues by the sensationalist narrative, by the sensationalist framing of the issues. And I think to a great detriment to ourselves and to our democracy, because if we are all operating on fantasy, on misinformation, then our democracy isn't functioning the way it should. It's based on the assumption of a well-informed citizenry, and that's what really concerns me.
I think you're 100% right. And the other issue, which I also think is a problem, is some of the political correctness that we seem to be forced to kind of deal with that reality. Also, that and kind of when you get some of the really really violent rhetoric that's going on, with also some of the political correctness, it really is a hard thing to do. I mean, I don't see any problem with just pointing out the fact that in Saudi Arabia, you can't have a Christian house of worship. I mean, that's reality, and that's just
reality.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right.
But
you're absolutely right.
And so we should be able to say that without being accused of being anti-Muslim in saying that. Just at the same time, we should recognize the fact that those who are the targets of a lot of this deviant Muslim are fellow Muslims who are perceived to be not so pure. And it's like,
absolutely.
And then we maybe can figure out how we do move forward. But anyway, Dahlia, you've been so generous with your time. I just want to thank you so much. And thank you for the work that you do in trying to raise understanding and help us to deal with, which is a very, very difficult, difficult situation. So thanks so much for joining us on Just Love today.
Thank you for having me.
Dahlia Mogahed, who is the Director of Research for the Institute of Social Policy and Understanding. And we're talking about some of the issues that we need to, in light of that criminal activity in Paris, in which people were killed, and how do we understand it? But even more importantly, how do we respond in a way which does, as we say, make our world more just and more compassionate? I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love on the Catholic Channel. Join us when we come back in 2 minutes on Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church in the world and the people who try to make our world more just and more compassionate. But each of us, if we just love God, neighbor, and self, we'll do our part and our world will be more just and more compassionate. You know, when we talk about justice and love and compassion, in our tradition, we always talk in three ways, as I always do: love God, love your neighbor, love yourself. And basically, to figure that out, all we have to do is go back to the first book of the Bible, the book of Genesis. And I think our listeners by now realize what a scholarly and an intellectual person we have who kind of does our board operations here in Angie. So,
oh, little old me.
I'm not going to comment on either of those two adjectives, but I will comment on the noun. It is you, right?
So, yes,
So I told Angie last week, I promised her that she'd get another apple crisp.
Which are my favorites.
Right, which are your favorite. If she could figure out from the first few chapters of the book of Genesis, what are the images that are there of the fact that we're together with God, together with other people, and together with ourselves, and then after the fall, that then there is that disruption in which there is not that togetherness. So what are the symbols of that? And so, Angie, what's the symbol or the image or the incident there which kind of indicates before the fall that humankind and God are together, that man and God are together? What's kind of the indication of that?
The Garden of Eden?
Well, it is, that's the whole story. Come on. So what's...
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole story. Thanks. That's like when you...
Well, I know.
That's
what I use. See, I know what it is. It's just hard for me, I guess, to... I mean, everyone is Adam and Eve. Like, mm-hmm. They're okay. Everything's in unity before the apple.
Well, here's the deal, okay? So the first part is...
Okay.
The indication that humankind and God are together is... that God and the human are walking and talking in the garden there. And God, after creating the things, he says to the man, he says, okay, now you name them. I've made them, now you give them their name.
Yeah.
And again, naming somebody is, in this context, is really like giving it its identity. So kind of God and man are good. I mean, they got this thing together.
Yeah.
I mean, and some of the theologians, some of the more mystical theologians would even talk about the man as being a co-creator with God because of how close they are there. So that's the first sign of the togetherness, okay? That they're walking and talking and co-creating. So what's the symbol and the sign of that human beings are together? Angie?
Adam and Eve?
Adam and Eve, and like that this one is the mate, the mm-hmm. and the two come together to form one flesh.
Yes.
So that's the second part. That's kind of in the book of Genesis where humans are together, that they're kind of together with one another.
Okay.
And so the third indication, this is not a trick, okay? This is not a trick. But what's kind of the symbol?
You're not buying it.
But what's the symbol or the sign in there or the incident that indicates that the people are okay with themselves?
They're naked.
You got it. Yes. Exactly.
I got one out of the three.
Now, if you know, as
ding, ding, ding.
As I say all the time, if you're in the American League, you win the American League batting title with getting one out of three.
Hey, better.
Okay. So we got those three things. Okay. Walking and talking, co-creating, God and man together. Secondly, man and woman together, humankind together, which the two become one flesh. And that we're okay with ourselves is the naked. Mm-hmm. That we let it all hang out and kind of we're okay with our nakedness. Mm-hmm. We're comfortable with ourselves.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay? Mm-hmm. So All right, so that's that. But then comes the fall, right? The eating of the
apple.
You are the fruit, right? Okay.
Oh, well, it's not an apple?
Did
they think it was? Yeah, everybody kind of said it was.
Uh-huh.
Well, I don't know. But okay. It says fruit. But if you want to say apple, we'll let you do apple. So, what is the indication that they were no longer even together with themselves?
Oh, is that my question?
Yeah, come on. You got this one right, so I'm now giving you...
I got this one right.
So what's the opposite?
They were leaves.
They were naked. They were ashamed. Mm-hmm.
They were ashamed, yes.
And they put the fig leaves.
Yes, okay.
So that is the sign that they no longer were comfortable with their very own beings, their very own bodies.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, how about the God part?
God doesn't walk with them anymore, right?
But what does it say they do there? What do they do?
What do they do?
They hid from God.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They said, and I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid.
They hid. Yeah, they
one.
Hid. Mm-hmm. No, that's it. That's it. They hid from God. Mm-hmm. So no longer are they walking. They're hiding from God. And the final one, okay, which I've often said is this is kind of the symbol for all time. So the two who are supposed to be flesh of one flesh, the two becomes one flesh. When God says to the man, says, so, hey, I told you, you weren't supposed to eat of this fruit. What happened?
He blames it on the woman?
Yep. Yep.
He does.
The one who is flesh of his flesh, bone of his bone, now there's separation.
Okay.
So the unity, the relationships which were real together, God and humankind with each other, mm-hmm. and each person with themselves, self, God, other, well, by the fall, the eating of the fruit or the apple, if you want to say that. Well, now there's that separation. There's a separation. Man hides from God. Mm. Man and woman turn on each other. She made me do it. And they were even so uncomfortable with their own body, they hid and they put fig leaves. And so now you have that separation. And now we'll go biggie. This wasn't part of the test, okay?
Okay.
But so when Jesus comes, mm-hmm. and he saves us, mm. his reconciliation is that he brings back together humankind and God, humankind with each other, and us with ourselves, so that the reconciliation, the wholeness, is a wholeness of those three essential and fundamental relationships. Mm. The relationship with God, mm-hmm. the relationship with others, and the relationship with ourselves. And unless we have all three of them together, we don't make it. That's what's critical. Enough of me talking. Let's take a break, and then I want to talk more about the just war theory. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us when we come back on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church in the world. We're now going to speak with Dr. Matthew Shaddle, who is the Associate Professor of Theology, Religious Studies at Marymount University. The reason I'm delighted that Dr. Shaddle will be with us is because I do think that our Catholic tradition and our Catholic wisdom and theology has something to say, very, very critically important to our world, about how do you respond to these violent situations. We've had a long tradition of a just war theory, which is fairly well developed. And I think the contribution that we as Catholics have to make to our world is to helping our country, if we're in the United States, is how do we respond in a way that's just? I mean, how do you respond not just to avenge, not just out of anger, not just out of emotion, but what are the criteria? How do we do this? And I have, as I said before, I am delighted that the Dr. Matthew Shaddle is with us, and he is a professor, at Marymount University in Arlington, Virginia. He's been in the faculty for the past couple of years. His book is The Origin of War, A Catholic Perspective, which was published in 2011. And so I'm delighted that he's agreed to be with us. Dr. Shaddle, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's nice to talk to you.
Great. So in kind of your studies, how did you get kind of interested in this particular area of theology?
Well, that's pretty easy to answer, because when I was in graduate school studying theology, it was I started my studies in the fall of 2001. So just, you know, a few weeks into school, we had the September 11th attacks, and then the run-up to the war in Afghanistan, and then 2 years later, the debate and the war in Iraq began. So that was just, you know, part of the public conversation. You know, being my age, people I knew were signing up for the military or had already been and were being deployed. So it was just part of the atmosphere, and it's raised questions for me that I wanted to pursue in my studies and ultimately my scholarship and writing.
So let me just ask you kind of an open-ended question. What contribution do you think our Catholic theology, our Catholic thought about the issues of the use of force, of responding to violence, what do you see that contribution being made? How do you see that contribution in the context of the current issues and incidents that we're dealing with?
Well, I was listening to your lead-in to introduce me, and it was I had already been thinking about. Now, this comes from a Methodist theologian, Paul Ramsey, but it's very much true for the Catholic tradition of thinking about war too. The way Paul Ramsey, in a way, defines the just war theory is that it's where the Christian love for your enemies and the love for your neighbor come into conflict. And it's a set of principles to guide you through that conflict. And I think that's one way that it could connect to our current moment very well, because on the one hand, you know, I think a lot of people are experiencing, you know, the past few years experiencing a lot of solidarity with the suffering of the people in Syria, want to reach out and protect them in some way. So you've got this love of neighbor. But on the other hand, you know, as Christians, we have a hesitation about violence. We don't, you know, Jesus says, blessed are the peacemakers. We don't, you know, want to use violence lightly. And even, I mean, we clearly have a sense that ISIS is an enemy. And yet, you know, our Lord says to love your enemies. So we have to find a way to navigate between loving our neighbors, the people in Syria and the people in France, and to love our enemies, ISIS. And so the just war theory provides a way to do that.
You know, Professor Shaddle, I think you've articulated very well the development of the just war theory that, I mean, and I know some people say, well, it comes from different places, but at the end of the day, no matter how you get to it, it is an attempt to limit war and to say, here are the circumstances in which it is okay, not good, but okay to go to war, and here are the ways that you should act when you are at war. It kind of is, it doesn't say everything's fair in love and war. It says there are some things that are not fair in even in war. So I think you've articulated that right. And this is my own perspective. My own perspective is that I think the world has changed, and some of the kind of principles and criteria of the just war don't square with the world we live in. I think the just war theory assumes a pretty non-fluid nation state in which you know who competent authority is and you know who the good guys are and who the bad guys are because you have armies and you have things like that. In the world we live in, the nation state is kind of not so important as it would have been 50 or 100 years ago. I'm not saying it's non-existent, okay? But, you know, when you have a movement such as ISIS, well, it's Iraq, it's Syria. It doesn't really care which side of the border that it's on. So, are there parts of the theory from your kind of scholarly thing that you think it's hard to apply in the current age, and we got to kind of think about maybe some different frameworks for it?
Yeah, I agree. And that's exactly why, you know, as with many things, the tradition evolves. It's not really a set of rigid rules that are, you know, that will, you know, provide us the answers for every, you know, possible situation that could arise. It's a tradition that's evolved over time precisely for changes like what you're talking about. And I think it's also important to point out that, you know, in terms of history, this idea of states as having states being so central to politics and having, you know, these tightly defined borders and tightly defined authority, that's actually only true the past few centuries. So you think about the Middle Ages.
That's even older than me. So I kind of consider that a pretty significant period of time.
Yeah, right. So for several centuries, but in the Middle Ages, right, I mean, you had the king, but then you had the dukes and you had barons and knights, and everybody had their own authority, can lead their own armies. So it was pretty fluid in other points in time too. So we're not, you know, completely without resources, but you're definitely right. And I was, if you think about ISIS, for example, so after the attack this Friday, the president of France very quickly declared that this was an act of war. But I think, you know, is that really what this was? Can a terrorist group perform an act of war, right? And ISIS is actually a tricky case because on the one hand, I mean, it's in their very name. They're the Islamic State. They claim to be a state, you know, exercising authority over a territory. But on the other hand, they operate in ways that are not like a state.
And in fact, I don't know about authenticity, but it seems the consensus is that they took credit for it and it was an authentic tape in which they took credit for the attack.
Mm-hmm.
So it in one sense, you know, you're right. They certainly have some characteristics. They certainly have some characteristics in which they act like a state or put them forth as a state. And then there are other ways in which they don't meet the criteria of being a state.
Mm-hmm.
The other issue, it seems to me, is that it gets real tricky in terms of collateral damage, in terms of not, you know, not innocent civilians not being targeted in a military thing. And how do you deal with the fact when you don't have, when you have those who are fighting are in the middle of cities and places like that? That to me strikes me as an incredibly difficult part of the just war theory, or the when a war is being fought. How do you carry that out? How are you faithful to that tradition and be effective in trying to combat the injustice that you've went to war about?
Right. I mean, you're definitely right that that's one of the complications, precisely because, I mean, as we've seen for years in Iraq, part of the strategy of groups like this is to blend in with the population and in some ways to intentionally maximize civilian casualties if they are attacked. I mean, they intentionally plan it. And I think though that's one area, while this is a evolution in the reality, I think our tradition serves us well, because the tradition gives us a way to evaluate the situation prudently, right? So we've got this concept, part of the just war theory is the concept of proportionality, right? That's part of the tragic aspect of war, is that there are always innocent victims, and that it gives us tools to weigh the military objectives and their importance at achieving the overall political aims of conflict against the maybe foreseen but unintended civilian casualties or destruction of civilian ways of life that go along with achieving those military objectives. So I think, I mean, we have some tools to wrestle with this. We don't have to start from scratch when we think about that.
So, Dr. Shadle, are there any particular aspects of research that you're working on at this time?
Right now, I've kind of turned away from looking at war. I'm looking more at what Catholic social teaching has to say about economic justice, because, again, you know, responding to what's going on in the world, I kind of started on this path with the recession in 2008, kind of looking for new models for thinking about.
Well, let me give you a topic that I think has been underexplored, so maybe you can do some exploration. I do think that our world and our international law recognizes refugee status from political persecution, from religious persecution, but does not recognize economic persecution. And I think that's an interesting topic to explore, to see where that takes us and how you might get there. So if you're looking at economic injustice, I think you crosswalk that with refugee policy and you see where it gets you.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely an important point. And so back in the post-World War II period, when the international refugee regime was set up, they made an intentional distinction between political refugees and economic migrants, making a clear boundary between the two. But you're definitely right that there's a lot of scholars and activists who argue that line has been drawn too sharply, that in some ways it's hard to distinguish one from the other.
Hey, right? Thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to be with us and to kind of help our listeners to kind of think about these issues, which are critically important as we move forward in the world. So, Dr. Shadi, thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate
you
being
with us. Okay.
Just Love, I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Today we talked in the aftermath of the tragic criminal activity in Paris, the attacks, about how we might think about it, how we might think about our neighbors, how we respond with force, how we try not to paint everybody with a broad brush. Thanks for being with us. Join us again next week on Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.